Good evening. People are going to wonder why that phrase, good evening, was so funny. Anyway, there we go. Tonight, the question is, has the Bible been changed? And look, that's a really great question to be asking. I think it's a great question if you're a Christian to be asking, because our faith as Christians is based on the Bible, isn't it? And even if you're not a Christian just visiting tonight, it's also a good question for you to be asking, because your Christian friends are asking you to change your life, to come to Christ and to change your life based on what the Bible says. And so the Bible is a foundation in all this. And, you know, if it's been changed, then that's obviously an important thing to know. It's also an important question for us to think about, because if you're not thinking about it, you're not going to understand a lot of what's happening within our culture. Because in our culture, and in fact in several cultures around the world, not just Western culture, the question, has the Bible been changed, is being answered all the time. And so there are books, there are movies, there are documentaries, all of which will just be having a go at the Bible in various ways. And there are some cultures around the world, like the Islamic culture, which has a very definite perspective that the Bible has been changed. So it's not just a Western thing, there are different cultures around the world which do this. So that question, has the Bible been changed, is actually being answered all around us. And if you're not aware of that, then you're probably just soaking up the answer that, yes, it has. Well, what I want to do today is to look at this question. And I'm just going to look at the last part of the Bible in particular, what Christians call the New Testament. And that's the part of the Bible that you could sort of say came with Jesus. I'm happy to have questions from the Old Testament later on, which is the first big section, but I'm just going to look at the last part of it, what Christians call the New Testament, just for the sake of time. Now, again, someone puts this question to you, has the Bible been changed? Part of the problem with even getting a question like that is you might think, how do I even go about answering it? You know, like, where do I get, you know, what do I do? If someone says to you, what's 57 multiplied by 36? You go, well, I'll get my calculator out and I know where to go to the answer. You know where to go for the answer. But when someone says, has the Bible been changed? Where do you even go for an answer? Where do you even go? I mean, I guess you could Google it and go, has the Bible been changed? And it would come up something there. But you're probably going to get a range of things. What I want us to do today is to look at the way that scholars would answer this question. I'm going to be looking at three particular questions. The first one is, who has had control of the New Testament? Now that's an important question, isn't it? Who's had control of it? The second question is to consider the traditions of the church and how that relates to the New Testament. And then the third point, and this is mainly the ones in which scholars in university would be involved in, this is to look at the old manuscripts that we have. And to look at the old manuscripts is called textual criticism. It's an important phrase. Don't be put off by the word criticism. It just means to examine very carefully. And so that the third point will be looking at textual criticism, and that'll be the biggest one. So that's where we're going to head. We're going to look at these three questions. And has everyone got a set of notes? Everyone grab a set as they can. Anyone not have a set? No, everyone's got a set. Great, because they're fairly comprehensive and I'm going to be referring to them. Well, the first question that I want us to consider is, who has been in control of the New Testament? Now, this is a very important question, because you need to have control over something if you want to change it. That's just fair enough, isn't it? That's straightforward. If you want to change the Bible, you've got to be in a position to do that. And the thing about the Bible, and particularly the New Testament, is that no one set of hands have been in control of it. No one set of hands have been in control of the New Testament. What happened was that the apostles of Jesus took the message of Jesus out, that they were preaching and writing letters and writing gospels and doing different things, and these just went out over a wide area, across into different kingdoms, into the Persian Empire, across into mainly in the Roman Empire, but across into the Persian Empire. And so it wasn't being done by a government. It wasn't being done by armies going out conquering and bringing their book with them. It was done by evangelists going out, but very often people being put to death for their faith as well. So a powerless people going out taking a message. And once the message had gone around, it just got established in different areas, and it wasn't under governmental control. And in those early years, it really wasn't even under a church control because the churches were still forming and establishing their networks. Now, what this means is that changing it is actually very difficult. Changing it's very difficult. I'd like you to consider one of the first quotes I've put there for you. This is a discussion from the 7th to 8th century between the Christian Emperor Leo III of the Eastern, or the Byzantine Empire, and Umar II of the Islamic ruler at that time. Now, Umar II has accused Christians of changing their scriptures. And so what's happening is the jihad is actually trying to conquer this Leo III. And so these kings are having this discussion. And part of the discussion that the Muslim brings is that the Bible is corrupted and Christians have corrupted it. Now, have a listen to what this early king says from the 8th century. "Such a thing, changing the Bible, as this would have been impossible among us. First of all, God has forbidden us to dream of such an audacious enterprise. Secondly, because even if someone, in spite of God's prohibition, had dared so to act, it would have been impossible for him to have gathered up all the books, spread abroad in so many different languages, procured and brought together skilled interpreters, and to have had all these interpreters examine the books so as to add and subtract according to his own idea." Now, you see how the king there is just reflecting something. Well, I'm reflecting what the king said, aren't I? And so he's saying, I'm the king of the Byzantine Empire, but our books have gone way beyond me. They've gone out into different languages. They've gone over into different kingdoms. I'm not even in a position as a king to standardise the books. So how could anyone else be in a position to do that? Many people think that the Roman Catholic Church has all the power in Christianity. You know, the Roman Catholic Church is the great conspiracy force, isn't it? In so many books and movies, they're always there. They've got some secret laboratory somewhere or like whatever it might be. Like, it doesn't matter what it is. They're often there, aren't they? And so people think the Roman Catholic Church have got all this power. Well, let me tell you that in the early centuries of Christianity, the Roman Catholic Church was a minor part. It was a significant minority, but there were just as many, if not more, Christians in the Byzantine Church, which was the Middle Eastern section, and then from Syria right across into India, that was a huge section of Christians across there, in the Persian Empire, which was actually ruled by the Zoroastrians, a different religion, but there were millions of Christians in there as well. And so in those early centuries, the Roman Catholic Church was in Europe, yes, along with the Orthodox Church, but it wasn't in charge. Now, all these, the Byzantine Church, the Roman Catholic Church, the Egyptian Coptic Church, the Ethiopian Church, the Syrian Church, they all had their own governments and their own ways of doing things, which were quite independent of each other. They would get together, but they were independent as well. And so the idea that the Roman Catholic Church can just do something over here, oh, you actually don't know church politics, right? It's just like that's the Da Vinci Code novels. It's got nothing to do with church politics. Now, I've brought up Islam a few times, and I want to bring this up because as the Islamic presence through the internet increases all the time, and as Muslims increase in our culture, one of the challenges they're increasingly bringing to Christians of Western culture is this issue of the Bible being corrupted. And it's also part of the way that they seek to convert people to Islam. They say the Bible's corrupt and the Quran's perfect. Now, at this point, we've got a clear difference between the Bible and the Quran. Have a look at this next quote that I've got for you here. Remember that when Islam went out, it did go out with armies, taking a book with it. And we read here that about 25 or so years after the death of Muhammad, the third Islamic ruler was faced with a situation where there were different Qurans being recited. And we read this: Uthman, O chief of believers, Uthman is the Islamic ruler, and someone is saying to him, save this nation, the nation of the Muslims, before they differ about the book, the Quran. Uthman sent to every Muslim province one copy of what they had copied and ordered that all other Quranic materials, whether written in fragmentary manuscripts or whole burnt copies, or whole copies, be burnt. Now, this is just from the Islamic history. And so you see, the Quran's actually got quite a different history. It was under the control of one group who were in charge of the government, in control of the armies. And so they actually were in a position to standardise it. Now, because the Christians didn't have armies, it was across in different empires, they just couldn't do that. So that's my first point. It's just a good bit of history to know that no one group has had control over the New Testament to change it on any global scale. Now, there have been changes. I'm not saying there haven't been, and we're going to look at some of those later on. But any changes that happen were done at a local level in one area. It was never global. It was just done in an area. So if there were changes, and we'll look at them, but we've got to get that bigger context. All right, let's move on to our second question now. And that was this idea of looking at the traditions of the church and the New Testament. Now, what I want you to do for a moment is just assume. I want you to be really sceptical of the Bible, and you're really sceptical, and say, what is the Bible? Well, it's just a book where the church is putting things in and taking things out. And they want to do something else, so they put that in. And then they don't like you, so they take that. And that's some of the view that people can have. You know, it's just a book that's reflecting what the church wants to teach. And so that's what it is. It's a book that's changing. Things are going in and out just to reflect what the church wants to teach. Now, if that was the case, then I think we can reasonably understand and know what the type of changes would be. If the Bible is just a book that is reflecting the traditions of the church, you know, as the church wants to bring something new in, it puts it in, it takes something else out. If that's what the Bible is, then it's reasonable to say that the changes that would be in it would be changes that support the traditions of the church. Okay, you follow my point? If the Bible is just reflecting what the church is teaching and is being changed to confirm that, then what we see the church teaching should be reflected in the Bible. It's very interesting that we don't see that. I'll give you a few examples. Consider the word Trinity. Now, don't worry, I believe in the Trinity. But it's very interesting, isn't it, that the word Trinity is not in the New Testament. And most of you are out there scratching your head saying, yeah, and I'm not too sure how to show it from the New Testament. Wouldn't it have been easier if the Bible was just being changed for Jesus to say, God is Trinity? And that would have just solved all the problem, wouldn't it? You'd say, well, there's the verse. Now, this is a word which is very important to Christian theology. It's accepted by all Christians, but it's not there. Now, why wouldn't that have just been put in? It would have made things a lot easier. Think about the dates of Christmas and Easter. I hope you watch, maybe you watch SBS News or something, and sometimes you'll hear that in Russia they're having Easter at this time, and it's a different time to us. Or they're having Christmas at this time, it's a different time. And you're sort of going, oh, that's odd. Why are they having it at different times? Well, in the early centuries of Christianity, there were arguments as to when you had Easter and sorting out these dates. Now, wouldn't it have been good if the Bible just had that for you? What's very interesting is that if you actually read the book of Galatians, it actually says that Christians have no dates, and that if you're following calendars and setting up those types of calendars and doing that, that's actually not what it's about. So that's interesting, isn't it? That having the calendar is not what it's about, yet the big church traditions are all about calendars and the dates for this. And which date is it? When the New Testament actually never speaks of that and actually says, don't go down that path. What about Jesus being God? Now, there's a famous verse in Mark 13, verse 32, where Jesus says, no one knows the hour of the coming of the Son of Man. So no one knows the hour of Jesus' coming, not even the Son of Man, not even the Son. And so that's troubled a lot of Christians, because if Jesus is fully God, how is it that he doesn't know something? Now, why hasn't that just been changed to just say, I do know the hour? You know, like, it just makes it a lot easier. The example that I want to look at in a bit more detail is the person of Mary. And if you're Roman Catholic, I'm not meaning to attack your position here or anything. I just want us to have a look at how Mary developed in church tradition and became very important, and what we actually find in the New Testament. In the Orthodox Church, and this would be the Coptic Church, the Eastern Orthodox Church, and the Roman Catholic Church. So right across the churches, Mary has taken on an enormous role. It's no longer just that she was a virgin when she conceived Jesus, but it's also that when she died, she was assumed from the grave, and that she has ascended up to God, to the left hand of God, as the Queen of Heaven. And that you can pray to her, and that she remained a virgin even after having Jesus. So she had no more children, and she remained a virgin, and so you can pray to her. Now, it's interesting that when you read the Bible, there are many verses which actually seem to challenge this quite strongly. In fact, a lot of them. And that's why I thought Mary was a better test case. Have a look at your references there. Look at the first one from Luke 11, verses 27 to 28. As Jesus was saying these things, a woman in the crowd called out, "Blessed is the mother who gave you birth and nursed you." There it is. There is someone. Blessed be Mary. Jesus is preaching. Blessed be your mother, Jesus. What does Jesus say? He replied, "Blessed rather are those who hear the word of God and obey it." So blessed rather is not Mary, but those who hear the word of God and obey it. Have a look at the next one. When Jesus entered a house, and again a crowd gathered, so that he and his disciples were not even able to eat. I'll let you get that there. When his family heard about this, they went to take charge of him, for they said he's out of his mind. That's interesting, isn't it? Here's the family of Jesus thinking that Jesus is out of his mind. It's not normally the type of picture we think of Jesus' family, is it? I wonder who the family members were that thought he was out of his mind. Then there's a few other verses where Jesus gives some teaching, and then it continues. Then Jesus' mother and brothers arrived. So his mother and brothers thought he was out of his mind. Standing outside, they sent someone in to call him. A crowd was sitting around him, and they told him, "Your mother and brothers are outside looking for you." "Who are my mother and my brothers?" he asked. Then he looked at those seated in a circle around him and said, "Here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does God's will is my brother and sister and mother." Now you see how Mary actually gets quite a low place in that. Yes, she has the virgin birth. We're not taking away from that. But you see how a lot of that, in an age where Mary is the Queen of Heaven, you pray to her, she's eternally the virgin. And I've also left it out, in Matthew 13, it actually talks about Jesus' brothers and sisters and names them. All of this is against the traditions that were prominent in the church. And so I want to say to you that if the Bible is just a reflection of what the church is teaching and just being edited to reflect this, then go and actually look at it, because the Bible very often, in fact often, rebukes the church. It rebukes the church and calls it to account. Now please don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that Christian teaching hasn't changed or evolved over time. I believe that it did, and that there were false ideas. But what I'm saying is that changing the Bible is not was not the means to carry this out. So what I'm saying here is that if you wanted to bring a new teaching into Christianity, there's actually better ways to do it. I think we can misunderstand how authority in the church operates. Throughout the history of the church, the Bible has been an authority. It's an authority, but it's only one amongst many authorities. And if you wanted to justify some Christian teaching, you didn't have to do it from the Bible. Very quickly in Christianity, a whole range of authorities developed, and you could appeal to these other ones. It's very difficult to change the Bible. It's much easier to do something else. For instance, you've got tradition. We've got these traditions in the church, and they're just beside the Bible in authority. Churches have these big councils, and in these councils, they give canons and decrees and anathemas and all these types of things. And they were binding on Christians. You didn't have to change the Bible. You have a council, come to a decision, and that was binding. People would claim visions and that an angel would come to them. And that was their authority, and people would follow that. Now, if you're familiar with is it in France, in Fatima? Are people familiar with the visions of the young children in Fatima? And so that is a massive movement of authority that came about from a visitation of Mary. So it's not in the Bible, it's just a spiritual experience. And some people tried to write new gospels, and we looked at that a couple of talks ago. So I guess what I'm trying to show you there is that when we look at the traditions of the church, the types of changes we would expect in the Bible are actually not there. And you've got to admit that, they're just not there. And that's because changing the Bible is not the best way to bring about the types of changes people wanted. There are other ways of doing it. Look, now, those two points I've just looked at there as to who's had control of the Bible and the traditions, they're just some historical background. So you can see that once you've got those things in mind, you can see that there's not really the desire to change the Bible in the way we might think there is. I think we can overestimate it. I think people can think that there's this conspiracy level that we must change the Bible. And it's just historically, it's just not like that. All right. That's a bit of history there. We're now going to change gears and do something much more scientific this time. Move away from the history to science. So please have a look at that next heading called manuscript evidence. Now, this manuscript evidence, this is much more like what you do if you go to a museum and you see old books in museums. Museums around the world for a couple of hundred years now have been collecting old manuscripts wherever they can find them. When interest in this first began in Europe, the Europeans would go into the Middle East to all the old monasteries and go through their libraries and try to find old books and buy them from them, and all these types of things happened. And it began a whole new level of scientific inquiry into the oldest manuscripts of the Bible. Now, there are three types of evidence that scholars in this area look for. They want to look for the old Greek copies of the New Testament. Remember that the New Testament was written in Greek. And so they want to get the original language that it was originally written in, and what are the oldest copies we've got there? The second thing they want to do is to look at the early translations. So it stayed in Greek, yes, and copies were always made, and they were the main copies in Greek. But translations were made into Syriac, into Latin, into other copies, and so we'll see later on that that's quite important. And also, the early theologians were quoting the Bible, and because they were quoting it, and their works have remained with us today, their quotes are a testimony to what their Bible was back in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th century. So they're the three sources that a scholar would go to answer this type of question as to, if I'm going to look at the old manuscripts, what are the manuscripts I need to look at? And by looking at them, I'm going to be able to make some conclusions. The old Greek manuscripts, the translations, and the quotes that people had. Well, let's have a look at the old Greek manuscripts. I've given you a table there from Josh McDowell's book. And I need to tell you that we actually have lots and lots of ancient Greek manuscripts of the New Testament. And it's helpful to look at this table to see how many we've got compared to other things that people just assume are fine. I've given you that table, but I'll pick out a couple of them. I guess many of us would have heard of Plato, the famous philosopher Plato. Now, he wrote in 400 BC. The earliest copy we have for him is 900 AD. So that's a gap of 1,300 years. 1,300 years for Plato, and we've got 7 copies. Okay. What about Tacitus? Tacitus is a very famous Roman historian, and he's from around the first century, so that's comparable to the New Testament. The earliest copy we have of him is from 1100 AD. So that's 1,000-year gap. 1,000 years, and we've got 20 copies. Now, what about the New Testament? Well, the New Testament is written within the first century, and we have a small fragment from around 114 or 120 AD. It's actually very close. This is for the Gospel of John. So 120 AD for a fragment. We've got books from around 200 AD. And from about 250 AD, we have most of the New Testament. And then by 325 AD, so this is only 250 years, we've got complete New Testaments. And when we then look at the New Testament, the Greek ones from that period onwards, we've actually got 5,366 manuscripts to work with, fragments or manuscripts. Now, you need to understand how significant this is. Bruce Metzger is recognised as the major scholar in this area. And he's written a book here on New Testament textual criticism. And this is what he writes. And I've got the quote there, I think, after the table. It says, "The works of several ancient authorities are preserved to us by the thinnest possible thread of transmission. In contrast with these figures, the textual critic of the New Testament is embarrassed by the wealth of his material." It's actually embarrassing how much we've got. If you look at any other book from the ancient world, the Bible trumps it every time. The New Testament trumps it every time. You just need to realise that. When people are making claims, oh, the Bible's corrupted, you know, we've actually got many, many ancient manuscripts that we can go and look at to look at this. Now, in addition, we've got the translations. Now, the translations are important because they're like a branch coming off a tree. So, say if, you know, the tree's down here and a branch comes off, say if it's the Syriac translation, which was around the 2nd century, that means it's a branch very close to the root, isn't it? So if the tree of Greek manuscripts are going up this way in time, you've got a translation from the 2nd century, it comes out and starts growing up over here, but it testifies to what the text was like right back at the 2nd century. Even though it's in another language, it still tells you something. And so all these translations are like branches coming off which testify to the Bible at various times. We've also got these quotes from the early church fathers, the early theologians. We don't just have a few quotes, though. We have thousands and thousands of quotes. In fact, we can almost reconstruct the whole New Testament from quotes. Isn't that amazing? That it was being quoted so much in those early centuries that you could actually go back to these early theologians, get these quotes and reconstruct it. So again, I've got a quote here from Metzger's book. "Besides textual evidence derived from the New Testament Greek manuscripts and from early versions, that is translations, the textual critic has available the numerous scriptural quotations included in the commentaries, sermons and other treatises written by the early church fathers, the early church theologians. Indeed, so extensive are these citations that if all other sources of our knowledge of the text of the New Testament were destroyed, that is, if all of our Greek manuscripts and translations, or if they're all gone, there would be sufficient, that these quotes would be sufficient alone for the reconstruction of practically the entire New Testament." Now again, there is no other ancient book in the world that compares with this. This is just what happens at university level. So this is what I'm quoting to here, just the university type books. Now, when we consider this, when we consider all this evidence, I've just been saying that the evidence is out there. When we look at it, what do we find? What do we find? Well, what we find is that the New Testament has been very well preserved and that there has been no rewrite of it. It's been very well preserved and there has been no rewrite. Now, there are differences between these manuscripts, and I want us to look at those now. There certainly are differences, and so I don't want to go exaggerating. And you've probably noticed this. You know, when you're reading your Bible sometimes, it'll have a footnote down the bottom. Have you noticed that? And it will say, some manuscripts say. Well, the reason it's saying that is that your translation is based on looking at all the ancient manuscripts, and it's telling you that some say this and some say that. Now, what are the types of differences that we find? Well, there are unintentional differences, first of all. Let's have a look at those. Now, this just could be where you're skipping a line. Some of the early Greek manuscripts, now imagine this, imagine having to copy this out by hand. Because paper and the animal skin was expensive, they didn't put any gaps between the letters because that just takes up more room. And so they're just writing and it's all in capitals, no gaps all the way across. And sometimes actually went like that even. These are the early days of books and the development of the script. And so you imagine writing having no gaps. Sometimes they would just be copying it out and they just skip a line. And so among some of the ancient ones we'll have, it'll just go from here and it'll just jump down. Okay, and so that's some of the differences that we find. Sometimes they may skip a line by having two words over the top of each other. Now, if you have a look at your notes there, hopefully that lined up in the PDF. See where it says, do not judge or you too will be judged. And then the line underneath it, for in the same way you judge others, you will be judged. And you see how it says you will be judged over the top of each other? One of the common mistakes we find is that the scribe has gone, you will be judged. And then when he looks back, he's gone to the wrong, you will be judged. And then he's done, it's like a step. And that's what happens as well. Sometimes they might confuse the letters. So if you look at an alpha, a lambda, a phi, a micron, theta, and a omega, you see how some of those are quite similar looking. And some of the scribes actually didn't know Greek. So they just might be writing it out. So they put their finger there, just do this, and that's what they're employed to do. If you're a scribe, you might be required to write in a language you don't know, just because that's you're a scribe, you're meant to just write whatever we put in front of you. And so sometimes that happens. Sometimes they might remember a bit of scripture and combine it from elsewhere. You know, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John have got similar stories, but yet slightly different details. Sometimes we find some of the details from Matthew might have come across into Mark or something like that. Again, we'll have a look at that, but that's the type of thing that might happen. Now, there were, though, sometimes intentional changes made. And I guess these are the ones we might be a bit more suspicious about, the intentional ones. So sometimes names of places will be updated as time goes on. As a location changes its name over time, that will be reflected in the scriptures and they'll change the name like that. Other times they might tidy up the grammar. Now, I think I've given you an example there. Remember that part of the way that they would have copied them would have been sometimes by sitting down and looking at this one and then writing it over here, and going like that. Sometimes, though, it was done by dictation. And so you might have a group of 20 scribes in a room and someone would have one copy and he would read it out, and as he read it out, the scribes would write it down. And that was a much quicker way of making a large number quickly. But people spell in different ways. So imagine if you spelt the word, and I think I've given you the example there, coming. You spell come, C-O-M-E, and coming, C-O-M-I-N-G. But imagine if you spelt it C-O-M-E-I-N-G. Now, that's sort of the types of differences that we have in the Greek language. Sometimes they have an epsilon at the end of a stem of a word. Normally that epsilon is assimilated in and isn't carried into the next, into the ending that's put onto it. But sometimes people left it there so that they would remember it's there. And so you'd have different letters being in there because the different scribe was writing it down according to slightly different conventions. Now, differences like that, they're all over the place.
So when you look at the New Testament, there might be thousands of those types of differences. But they're just slight differences in how the grammar's been passed on and the grammatical rules. There are some bigger ones, though. So the end of Mark's Gospel, there's 12 verses at the end of Mark's Gospel which don't appear to be original. And that's where someone's tried to tidy up the end of Mark. Mark's Gospel ends very abruptly. The women find the empty tomb, and then it seems to finish there. But then you'll see that in later manuscripts, it has a longer ending. And so there are some bigger ones. And so there's that big end there. There's the Jesus talking with the woman caught in adultery in Mark chapter 8. And you'll see that in your footnotes. And there's quite a deliberate one in 1 John chapter 5, verse 7 to 8. Now, that's in the King James Bible, but it's not in the modern translations because it's actually not in the Greek New Testament. From the research I've done, it's in the Latin translations and somehow made its way into the King James Bible. It's a very Trinitarian-sounding verse. But there are some other bits in there which look like they've been deliberately put in, and they're not just accidental mistakes, they're not just someone tidying up the grammar and the spelling, but these look like there are a few sections. Again, don't get me wrong, this is a tiny percentage. It's like 0.1% or something where there's been a deliberate change. Now, I've pointed out a whole lot of errors, and I've actually said to you that there's thousands of these throughout the manuscripts, some which make no difference at all, others which are quite significant. Is this a problem? Well, I want to say to you, it's not a problem. In fact, it's fantastic. This is the best problem to have. Just imagine if you had one manuscript. Just say if you had one copy of it. Then when you were reading that, you would not be in a position to know how this compared to anything else, would you? Because you've only got one. When you have thousands of them, all of a sudden you can compare them across a big area. And having differences isn't really a problem because you can use simple deduction to identify the errors. Now, scholars do this because these manuscripts, when they were copied, are copied in what's called family groups. That is, down in Alexandria in Egypt, which was famous for its parchments and everything, they were making copies of the New Testament there. And copies were being made of copies, and copies were made of copies. Can you see that picture that I've made there for you of the family trees? Then over in Rome, they're making copies of theirs. They're a couple of thousand kilometres away, and they've got their own family trees making copies of copies of copies. Then in Caesarea, up near Jerusalem, there are Christian institutions there, and they're making copies of their own copies and their own copies up there. And then where's the other one? And then, of course, there's Byzantium in Constantinople, which was another big centre of Christian learning, and they're making copies and copies. And so what it means is you've sort of got these family trees, which to some degree, not completely, but to some degree, are independent from each other. Now, what this means is, say that someone's a real heretic, a deliberate heretic, will assume the absolute worst. So it's got to be in Rome, doesn't it? Because that's where it would obviously be. And so this person's there and he wants to change it all, so he changes the manuscripts. And then the people after him, they're really pious, because a lot of Christians in Rome are very pious Romans. Very pious Christians. And so they're very, very pious. And they copy exactly what's there. They're very careful. But of course, they're now copying the mistake and the error that's been passed on to them, haven't they? So that one person can corrupt it for everyone else in the tree after him. But you know what? His change does not affect the people in Egypt and their copies. And his change does not affect the people in Caesarea and their copies. And his change does not affect the people in Constantinople. His change affects the people in his family. Now, what scholars do, and I've given you a list here, you see all these lines, how they've just simply compared the different families. And what they simply do is lay them all down together. They've got thousands of these in these different groups. They lay them down, and go through it word by word. And what they find is that if one of them says something, but the other three say something else and they all agree, well, then it's simple deduction to say there's been some type of error there. And it's relatively as simple as that. Again, it's not an exact science, but it's still a fairly reliable science that they can do. Now, this is what scholars do. They go through all the manuscripts and they basically just say, right, this one says that, these ones say this, and we work it out. And that's where your footnotes come from in the Bible. Now, when we do that, what we find is that the Bible is very well preserved. Yes, there are these errors in transmission that have crept in over time, but these must not be exaggerated. It is in no way that the message of the New Testament has been changed. No way at all. We've got the manuscripts going back earlier than for any other manuscript. And it shows that the Bible has been genuinely preserved. Yes, there are differences that have crept in, but because, as I said, of the how it's been spread out, we're able to nowadays to get them together and to do the work and to be sure on the text. And so Christians do not hide this. Again, it's this whole conspiracy theory that there's, you know, secret things that Christians are hiding. If you just get any modern Bible, so one of the Bibles that we have here, and you look at probably about every second page, you might find a footnote saying some manuscripts say this or some manuscripts say that. We're really open about it. We're very open about it. The New Testament Bible that I use here, you're not going to be able to see this, but you can come and have a look. In its footnotes, it gives you all these family groups and gives you all the data so you can actually read it for yourself. Again, we're not hiding it. It's all very open. It's all out in the open. And it actually shows that the Bible's been well preserved. So look, to conclude, I just want to say the Bible's been well preserved and there's ample evidence to show this. So let's not go exaggerating. The Christian shouldn't exaggerate and say, absolutely perfect, not a single variant. No, there are. That's an exaggeration. But you can't exaggerate the other way and say, oh, it's corrupted, you can't trust it. That's absolutely false. You're not going to have scholars saying that. No, it's been well preserved. And look, the great thing about that, it means that if you want to take Christianity seriously, if you want to find out about Jesus, you can do that. Don't let any thought that the Bible's been corrupted stand in your way, because the evidence is in and the evidence shows that it's been well preserved. Thank you very much.